Good show. Hi everyone. You must be wondering, where is the hello? Well, I have to tell you that for the first time and probably for the last, I asked Fabi if I could do this episode all by myself. The reason being is because this is probably one of the last opportunities I have to truly show my voice in the podcast. Not that I have not done before. I've been very fortunate to share this space with Fabi, but I'm bringing you probably the most important interview I've ever done here in the podcast. You've heard me say her name before many times. Kirsten this, Kirsten that. Well, Kirsten said that, and Kirsten esto y lo otro, y guara guara la cuchara. And the reality is that she's going to be mad at me, but she didn't want to be in the podcast. I think she was afraid of what she will say. So part of the reason why I was excited to start the podcast is because I wanted to interview her. I remember fantasizing about this. And this was back 5 years ago. And here we are. She finally agreed. She lives in Albuquerque. Kirsten Pye Buick, a full professor at the University of New Mexico. She's been my school since 2007. She is one of the most important people in my life. She's family more than anything. Everything that a lot of the woke things that you hear me say in the podcast, it stems from conversations with her. Together with Francisco Guevara in Arquetopia, which you already heard that interview, which I've heard a lot of my friends that are artists that have been impacted by that interview, because we really go into detail about the responsibility and the ethics of being an artist. Together with Francisco and Annette Rodriguez in North Carolina, they form the network of my most important mentors. I've had a wonderful people throughout not only my undergrad and my graduate studies, but between them three, they make every single word that I've said in this podcast. And I've had interview Annette, I've had interview Francisco, but not Kirsten. So it's the turn for Kirsten. We talked about a lot of different things. We get very art historically, so just bear with us at some point. But a lot of the basic ideas that we've been talking in the podcast are laid out in the most beautiful way, as she always does, by Kirsten Buick. So without further ado, here is my conversation with my love, Kirsten. Hello, audience of Latinos Who Lunch. Babelito here, talking to you from Albuquerque. This is our third interview in our Badass Women of Art History. And today I have the pleasure and the privilege. Let me put it this way. So ever since, if you've been listening to the podcast since the beginning, you've heard me always say, oh, Kirsten said this and Kirsten said that. Well, Kirsten says this. Well, Kirsten says that. And in all honesty, since I started the podcast, one of the reasons why I wanted to start the podcast is because I wanted to interview people like Kirsten, more specifically Kirsten. So guess what, Mimi? Kirsten's made it into the podcast. Kirsten Pye Buick, full professor from the University of New Mexico. Welcome, Kirsten.
Happy to be here.
So, so happy. A privilege. I know a lot of our listeners have been waiting for this interview for a while. So needless to say, I'm very excited and very caffeinated and very nervous. So let's talk about food first. So let's talk about yesterday's food.
Let's talk about yesterday.
Okay, what did we eat?
We had chilaquiles, or however you say it, chilaquiles.
Chilaquiles, yes. What is it about Mexican food that you love, and what is it about New Mexican food that you don't love? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I love Mexican food because of its complexity.
Yes.
It is, it doesn't try and disguise what it is through sauce, or it's not sauce heavy the way French food is. It can stand on its own a lot of the times, and it's just very diverse and very, I think, sophisticated.
Right. I think there's aspects of New Mexican food.
Back to Mexican food.
Okay. Yesterday we had chilaquiles that my husband made.
Yes.
And this is based on a recipe from Jauja Cocina, from which is a YouTube wonderful, wonderful channel. I think she's slowly being appropriated by the empire. Now she's selling her own salsas and she's becoming better.
Good.
But I mean, I guess good for her. This is a salsa that has chile ancho, chile guajillo, and he added chile de árbol. So you mix all, like you mix all the salsas, you make your own salsa, and then on the side you have tomatillos. So you basically have two salsas and then you fry them together. That's why it's so good.
It was wonderful.
It was good. It was good. So that's what we had for lunch yesterday. We came here and assembled it all for you with queso fresco.
You assembled everything but the podcast.
That's what do you mean?
I mean that when it was time to interview me, you opened the bag and there's nothing in there but Christmas lights.
Calling me out. The thing is that we are in Santa Fe. Kirsten is in Albuquerque. So we drove here 35, 40 minutes. And I had all my equipment in a box because I keep all my podcast equipment in a box.
Except for the thing you needed the most.
Except for
and
the
how
recording
long have you
machine.
Been doing this?
Too long. This is why it's ending.
Clearly.
That's why we're going on our fifth year and it's ending. But I'm actually very happy and I'm very, very privileged that you are one of our last interviews. You, Nandi, and Josie Lopez from the Albuquerque Art Museum.
Well, when I found out you were ending the podcast, I said I should be on there.
Yeah, I'm very happy because I don't know. There's a lot of things we talked about in the podcast, and there are conversations that you started. So I just adapted it to the podcast. So for that, I know all of our audience is thankful to you. And like both Fabi and I are very thankful because we have started dialogues that are just now coming into the Latinx podcast world that we started like 5 years ago. And it's because of what I learned with you in the classroom. So like I couldn't finish the podcast without having you in the podcast. So it's very, very exciting.
Well, one of the things I'm grateful for is that all of my students are better than I am.
How so?
Your dissertations were better than mine could have ever been. You came out of the gate publishing and professional in terms of lectures and public presentations. Between you, Annette, Paco, and Shayna, you've just all been stellar.
I'm very thankful to be part of that lineup. And it's so exciting that everybody's been in the podcast. I was talking to you yesterday and say that all of my mentors by now have been on the podcast. So it's very exciting. So let's talk about teaching.
Well, let's talk about lunch today.
Oh, okay. Let's do it.
Popeyes.
It was good.
That's no way to start a podcast.
What?
With Popeyes or Popeyes.
Well, I mean, I guess the proper way was the chilaquiles.
Yes.
But yeah, I brought Popeyes. I don't have Popeyes just because I try to avoid fast food, but no shade. But every time I have it,
it makes you sick.
No.
No? It doesn't give you like oily diarrhea?
No, actually not yet. just had it 20 minutes
make
ago.
Make sure you're out of my house when it hits.
No, like I love it. I've been hearing about this sandwich for a year and it was pretty amazing.
I've been eating it all my life.
The sandwich?
No, Popeyes.
What is it about Popeyes and not KFC?
My mama wouldn't fry chicken.
Oh, I see. That's a good answer. No, it was good. The macaroni and cheese, though, it failed.
It wasn't fresh. Mm-hmm. And what's shocking is the lines out of the driveway, and they still managed to serve you stale chicken.
Yes.
It's kind of miraculous. I think there's a saint of stale chicken.
I think so. And it lived.
It touches.
They have a shrine in every Popeyes. Well, whatever it was pretty good. But I have to say, I always have to have pastries and eggs in the morning. So I made a sacrifice for you and I didn't have eggs this morning. I only have chicken. I cannot have them together.
That eggs was no chicken. Sacrifice for me. You forgot for your me. Equipment yesterday.
True. I have to.
And then the time changed and I got this sad text.
I said, so the time has changed. And she texted back. And I knew I wasn't going to make it earlier. I went to bed. It was like 4:30.
I knew you wouldn't either, but I just wanted to give you a hard time.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Okay. Everybody knows you're my mentor, but who is Kirsten Pybjork?
Who is she? She's still trying to discover that. Not really. I grew up in the 70s when made-for-TV movies were super popular, and I was always puzzled by all the made-for-TV movies with white women having to leave their families to find themselves. While my mom is waking up at 3 a.m. to drive across a very racist part of town, Cicero.
Oh my God, yes.
From Chicago to Cicero, through Cicero, to work at Lever Brothers.
That was in the, what was Lever Brothers at?
I forget the same name of the suburb, but she was always a target because she was obviously black driving through Cicero.
And so you grew up in Chicago?
Grew up in Chicago, yes. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. My family came there from Arkansas in 1938. Mm-hmm. And they moved to a neighborhood right next to what is now the University of Chicago. And it was University of Chicago then. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up going to public school. I was an unremarkable student because I was lazy. I would rather read than go to school. My mom said, well, you know, this is your life. If you, you know, at least spell my name right on your excuse notes that I would write for her. She got a phone call one day. It's like, I know she's sickly, but she brought in a note and I don't think this is your name. My mother said I was tired when I wrote it. So she always covered for us as long as we were honest with her. And I'd rather read than go to school. So they just thought I had issues.
What did you like to read as a kid?
I read everything. I read science fiction. I read romance novels. I read nonfiction. Anything I could get my hands on, I would read.
That's why you're such a good writer.
Yeah, well, I didn't start reading till I was 13. Oh. I mean, I didn't start like reading for pleasure until I was 13.
I remember I did a lot of reading in high school, and then I started college, and I learned to hate.
Well,
reading.
The purpose of college is to kill your spirit.
And it was successful. Speaking of college, you did your undergrad at the University of Chicago.
I was one of a few public school students, black, who got into the University of Chicago. And I got in because I like to read. I was number 20 in terms of class rank in high school. Like I said, it's because I was lazy and I never showed up. I would show up for test day. I was such a good writer by the time I graduated high school that they let me have the inside page of the yearbook to write my poems. And everybody thought I was dead. That was a memorial page. All the dead girl's poems.
My God.
Yeah, that's punk. I can be the dead girl.
Oh, wow. And you decided to go to the University of Chicago because I had family,
we had a teacher, a Spanish teacher, Mrs. Murphy. And we think we're not sure. She might have been from the Dominican Republic. But she always had all these anti-black things to say.
Oof.
Well, she was hilarious. And we played music and cheat on our exams and we dance during class and she'd tell us, stop that sensuous gyration.
Oh, what?
Yeah, so we always quote Miss Murphy. But she told me that at the University of Chicago, you could meet students from all over the world. And so I said, okay, I'll try that. not knowing that my chances of getting in were almost zero.
Oh.
But I had been actively recruited by Augustana College to go there, and they would have, they admitted me. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have to apply. They drove us up one weekend and it rained and all these worms came out of the ground. Also, I'm not going to this devil campus.
The apocalypse is happening as we speak.
Exactly. So when I got my acceptance to University of Chicago, it's like, yeah, I'll go there.
It made sense.
This is how I was smart, right? Mm-hmm. I was the first person in my family to go to college. Mm-hmm. My grandpa was a welder. My grandpa was a construction worker. My dad was a welder. My mom was a secretary. My grandma worked in the cannery for Campbell's Soup. And so her advice could follow me, but only so far.
Right.
But I'd watched my peers go off to college before me, and they all wanted to go away because they all wanted to get out from under their parents' influence. But we never had a curfew.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it was a different experience.
Right. And so I knew that a lot of them had gone away and failed. Mm-hmm. And they would come back and get these jobs in retail. And I didn't want that to happen to me. And I still like my parent and my grandparents. And so I didn't want to leave. So I knew that in order to succeed, I had to be close to home.
Right.
And so I went to University of Chicago, and I actually stayed on campus. I lived in campus housing.
But that was like the neighborhood. It was like so close, so close to where you lived. So you still got to see your family all the time. Yep. Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. How was your experience at University of Chicago as an undergrad?
It was horrible.
Why?
Because the first day during orientation, they sat us all down and before we proceeded to our seats, they made us buy a whistle for a dollar. So I'm sitting there with this silver whistle in my hand. Then they start talking about how dangerous the surrounding neighborhoods are that this whistle is your protection from, you know, the rapists and murderers that surround the campus.
In your own neighborhood.
Yeah. The neighborhood my grandpa had settled in. And I'm looking around feeling very disoriented.
Right.
Right? As opposed to oriented. And so I decided at that moment that they never had the right to teach me about African history or African American history or anything about Blackness, that instead I would study whiteness, and that specifically I would study white racial formation.
So that's what you did for 4 years?
Yep. I studied Italian literature. Mm. I studied art history, and always with an eye to whiteness.
So that's what drove you into art history, a study of whiteness.
Yep.
Interesting. And you got your undergrad, and then did you knew you were going to finish and continue, or you decided that along the way, or what happened?
So I majored in Italian literature and art history. Mm-hmm. And of course, none of my family understood what I was doing.
Right.
When my mom found out I was majoring in romance languages, she thought it had something to do with Harlequin romance. She said, okay, explain this to me once and you will never be questioned about your major by anyone in this family ever again.
Oh, wow.
So I explained it to her. She said, okay.
That makes sense.
And no one was ever allowed to ask me questions or look sideways at me or challenge my choices. And my grandpa, V, he was always very proud. He didn't understand what I was studying and would tell people that she was studying foreign English. That's what amazing. Italian was to him. Foreign English. Yes.
You know, it's interesting because that's sometimes first generation kids, a lot of BIPOC kids, mm-hmm. that's their experience. They have to constantly justify to their communities mm-hmm. why they study. Mm-hmm. I remember going to Juarez, even when I was here getting my PhD, it was always labor trying to explain how and why, because historically speaking, those are the disciplines that never represented us, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes labor. So why did you decide to stay in art history? After you learned what you had to learn, after you saw what you had to see, why continue with art history?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you why. One of the reasons I ended up looking at it seriously, and this is just as important as the intellectual stuff. Mm-hmm. I went through the course catalog and none of the classes met before 10 a.m.
Okay.
I am not a morning person.
Me neither.
And you have to realize your relationship with time, mm-hmm. and plan accordingly. And I knew I wasn't a morning person. I knew that I need the mornings for myself. Mm-hmm. And I looked in the course catalog and I thought, what a civilized major. I can do this.
They understand time.
And then, you know, going into teaching, they further understand time.
Right.
3 months off every summer, a month off at Christmas, once every 5 years, 8 months off paid.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yes. So be realistic about your needs with regard to time.
Right.
I've always been very real about that.
Yes, you have.
And, you know, when I first got to UNM, they gave me a 9:30 a.m. class. But as I moved up in seniority, uh-huh. I don't teach before 11.
I remember I took a class with you. It was at 11. Mm-hmm. And you used to complain about how early it was.
That was early. That's early for me. That is a sacrifice.
It is a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So besides your relationship with time, mm-hmm. why art history?
Because visual culture, visual studies, I think is one of the most urgent and remains the most urgent issue of our time. Mm-hmm. Visual literacy is imperative. Mm-hmm. There's a reason, for example, that at the Creation Museum, they just don't have pages of the Bible stuck up on the wall.
Right.
They need the visual. And so they have...
And they always have. The Bible always needed the visual.
So they have semi-naked Adam and Eve, kind of brown, in a pool.
Safely brown.
safely brown, and effing dinosaurs. Uh-huh. There. And so that's how they prove, quote unquote, that the earth is only 6,000 years old.
Oh my God. Yes. I saw a whole documentary mm-hmm. about it in PBS. Mm-hmm.
And so we need the visual. Mm-hmm. We need the visual. And the more advanced I get in my scholarship, the more I only write about landscape representation. Mm-hmm. And it's because our social relations are determined by our spatial relations.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that how we understand ourselves relative to one another mm-hmm. depends on how we negotiate space and how we are allowed to negotiate space by the state, by the police, by bathroom demarcations, traffic lights. All of these things help us navigate a terrain.
That's right. And so you were focusing on Italian studies.
Yes.
You even ended up going and spending some time mm-hmm. in Italy.
Yes.
And
it's because Italian Renaissance art is the very foundation of white art history.
It is.
And so I went to the heart of whiteness. Yes.
Wow. And how was that experience? How long were you there?
The first time I was there 6 months and uh-huh. then an intermittent, this is the late 80s. And then intermittently I go back and work in the archives or visit. And then the second time, another 6 months and then visits thereafter.
Do you like it?
I despise Europe.
Okay. That makes
sense. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's true.
I do not like it. I feel like the conversations we've been having in this country for 300-400 years around race and gender,
right?
They're just figuring out how to start having.
Right now.
Right now.
Even though they...
Because their colonial chickens are coming home to roost.
True.
And so I'm not enchanted by Europe. Mm-hmm. There's no place on this earth that's an escape for me.
Right.
With the exception maybe of St. Martin. Mm. Those islands in the Caribbean that are still inhabited by their European overlords. And so the population there learned to hate them. So they're nice to black people and they're nice to non-white people.
So with that in mind, thinking about space, thinking mm-hmm. about escape, you have created a space for yourself here in your home. Mm-hmm. So is this the place where you get to escape?
Yes. Home is my refuge, and New Mexico is. Mm-hmm. And my students, I feel very fortunate in the students I found here. Also, one of the things I've done as a faculty member is join every search I was asked to join. Mm-hmm. And I know that, and rightfully so, service weighs particularly heavy on non-white faculty and non-male faculty. But I joined every search I was asked to serve on, and I volunteered for a number of searches. And that's why at the University of New Mexico, half of the art history faculty is non-white.
Right.
They are people of color.
That's important for your home.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. So that you shifted from Italian studies mm-hmm. and you started looking into the art of Edmonia Lewis in Michigan?
In Italy.
In Italy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah.
First, tell us who Edmonia Lewis is and then how you, okay. your relationship with her.
All right. So, but first, 6 months in Italy,
uh-huh.
Where Little House on the Prairie was screened 2 times a day, dubbed into Italian. Jurassic Park was just about to be released internationally, and the French didn't want Jurassic Park there because they felt it would ruin how they experienced cinema.
Oh my God.
And the Italians were making fun of them. And I realized that not only was our number one export racialization,
right,
but also visual culture. Mm. And so it was in Italy that I became curious about the United States.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so I was there working on a master's thesis on Ghirlandaio. And then I went back to Michigan, University of Michigan, where I was in grad school. And I took a class on U.S. art. And I wrote a paper that my professor loved and said, maybe you should turn this into your master's thesis. And I'd been struggling with my Ghirlandaio paper. So
Ghirlandaio being a Renaissance uh-huh. male artist.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, I just declared that desk cursed. And
you moved to another one.
I moved another desk into my bedroom. Uh-huh. And that was the desk for Eastman Johnson's old Kentucky home, a painting made in 1859.
Uh-huh.
And so my professor at the time realized that he didn't have the capacity to teach African-American art. So, you know, this is the early 90s and African-American art was not part of U.S. art.
Right.
Or it just wasn't taught as part of it. And so he hosted a symposium and he allowed me to present my master's thesis. And he invited Richard J. Powell, who teaches at Duke.
Mm-hmm.
He invited him to give a paper. And it was my first public
symposium. Yeah.
presentation. I was so nervous. Uh-huh. And I was mic'd and the mic was on my chest and I could feel this burp rising. It's like, okay. And I'm thinking as I'm reading my paper, how do I negotiate
this
powerful expulsion of air? Okay, but aside from that,
uh-huh.
I was thinking about writing a dissertation on genre painting.
Which is?
It is the painting of everyday life.
Okay.
And, you know, I later went on to create a seminar around it. But I asked Rick Powell, I said, should I write on genre painting or what else is there? What needs to be done?
Right.
And he said, Edmonia Lewis.
Flat out like that.
Yep. He said, Edmonia Lewis. I said, okay.
What a nerve.
I said, okay.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm. And so she is Ojibwe, or she was Ojibwe and African American.
19th century.
19th century, born in upstate New York around 1844. And by the time I was writing my dissertation, we still didn't know when or where she died. We mm-hmm. only recently discovered that after living and working in Rome since 1865, at some point she moved to London. 1901, she moves to London, and she dies there in 1907.
Mm.
But she was a sculptor, created works in marble, neoclassical sculptures.
Mm-hmm. And her work is everywhere in the country, but there's several pieces in the Smithsonian, right?
Yes.
Okay. What was it about Monia Lewis that, because I'm sure he said studied Monia Lewis, but then you looked at her and you're like, yes, mm-hmm. this is where I'm from.
Yes. Because she had no biography. Mm. And I know that the problem with artists who are not white or who are not male is the problem of biography. Mm. That they're any little incident gets reflected back into their work, and the work becomes a very limited representation for art historians mm-hmm. of their most narrowly understood identities.
And speaking of Hermonia Lewis, the identities are complicated and mm-hmm. almost probably why that's the reason people didn't take on her biography, female, Native American, and African American. So how do you negotiate identity and in relationship to her art in what later became your book?
Mm-hmm. I did it by creating and trying to understand contexts, various contexts in which she was working. Mm-hmm. And so abolitionism, sentimentality, true womanhood, ideals around femininity, what was happening in Italy in the 19th century. And that's how my work in Italian actually came back to help, because I could dive into the archives and I could read everything mm-hmm. and understand everything that I was picking up. And I made friends with booksellers and bookstore owners, and they gave me material that wasn't necessarily on the shelves.
Mm. How did she negotiate a lot of those it's forces upon which she was creating or avoiding creation in her work?
She made connections and friendships with people that aren't necessarily visible to us, because, you know, if her white patron didn't see it, it didn't happen and it didn't exist.
Right.
And so even as she was negotiating the difficulties of white patronage that was built largely on her identity as African-American, they didn't so much care about the indigenous side of her identity, mm-hmm. except anecdotally. Mm-hmm. And so she became fluent in Italian. She went to the French opera. She'd go over to France and go to the opera. She was multilingual and developed friendships with English Catholics and with American Catholics, because she knew that abolitionist patronage would dry up.
How did Monia Lewis fomented your hate for art history, or how did it change it? How did it change your relationship with art history? That's a better way to frame that. To frame that question.
I still despise art history.
Me too. Thanks to you.
One of the second essay I ever published about her was for the Philadelphia Museum of African American History and Culture. Mm-hmm. And it was for an exhibition on Black women sculptors. And I decided in that essay, which was very different from the essay I published for the Smithsonian in 1995, I decided to investigate what it meant to call her exotic. Mm. And so I just compiled a file of every time she'd been called picturesque or exotic from the 19th century through to the 20th century. And I realized that to be called exotic is to be displaced from the terrain. Mm. It is to be displaced spatially. And so it eliminated her as competition. It eliminated her as a voice, as a contributor to these larger discourses around sentimentalism and abolitionism. And my advisor at the time, when he read the essay, called and said it was screechy and typical graduate student overload.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So, that was going to be my next question. What was the reception of this material in such I'm going to say in the 90s, still very conservative
field. Very conservative, and you're not supposed to name names. You're supposed to pretend like it was never written. But I didn't want students who came after me to read this material unmediated. That I wanted to be the one to push back and to actually interrupt this easy discourse around exoticism. And so my response was to finish my PhD so no one could ever say that to me again. But the thing it did, it was it threw me off the what my it threw me off of what my book was about. It threw me off of what my dissertation was about. Because ultimately, when I kind of found my way back into that discussion, one of the things I realized is that she was either considered subversive and a kind of proto-feminist, or she was exotic.
Like nothing in between.
Nothing in between. And so in allowing myself to go back to the discussion around exotic, I was able to also consider what subversive meant. And this discussion of her as subversive also kicked her out of the terrain.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of labor.
Yeah. Well, that's what, yeah.
No, but I'm thinking because I remember one time you said to me, you're going to develop PTSD out mm-hmm. of your dissertation. Mm-hmm. Now I know where that came from.
Yes. That's where it came from.
Yeah, because it's not only you're just doing a dissertation, but you also have to resolve a lot of issues around the discipline in which you're writing that dissertation yes. for.
You're fighting all the time and you're tired and you don't know how tired you are until you're sitting at my kitchen counter saying that I'm gonna postpone turning in my dissertation.
When I was finishing my dissertation, I was given corrections. I was asked to eliminate a whole entire chapter and hundreds of corrections. And it was after a very complicated year, but like everybody has complicated years. But obviously I thought mine was the most complicated. So I came to Kirsten's house because I was living here in New Mexico with Madalena's mom, which they both have been in the podcast with La Judy. Shout out to La Judy. And I came here and I said, nope, I am not going to continue to do this. I'm tired. I'm done. And you said to me, you're not leaving this house till you finish. Mm-hmm. I was like, but I have no calzones. I have no underwear. And you're like, you stay here. I'll go to the store. I'll buy you some. And you're going to finish. So we came to an agreement. I will come here every morning for a week and just work on that. And I sat in that kitchen. I think for 5 or 6 days mm-hmm. straight, you will feed me mm-hmm. and you cut me from not collapsing. Mm-hmm. I was collapsed.
Yep.
You picked me up again and you made me finish.
Yes.
And that's, this is in relationship to what I wanted to ask next. How do you then take on the role of an advisor in a discipline that has not been graceful mm-hmm. to you in your career?
Mm-hmm. Because if there, the degree of resistance that you face mm-hmm. is the degree of fight that you bring to it. My mother taught us to relish the fight. And, you know, I had met your parents in Mexico. And
oh, that's right. You met them in Puebla.
I held your mother's hand uh-huh. and I told her, I'll see you at his graduation. And there was no way I was going to let you not let me see your parents again.
And we. And you did.
I love your parents.
Shout out to La Clemen and Pepe.
I love your parents.
They love you. They know what you mean to me. I always talk about you and everything you've done for me. Because you have mentors in school, but then you have mentors in life. And you have become both to me. And I see the repercussions of what your mentorship has done to me, and I am modeling my career after you exactly because of what you did for me. And I know where I was. I know how lost I was without knowing how lost I was. And we just had this conversation yesterday. We don't have to.
We don't have to have it again.
So it's very, very important for me. And I think it's, I had this moment last week, and I told you, where the conversation in my classroom shifted to this existential conversation that to a certain degree had everything to do with the material that I was presenting, but had nothing to do with the material that I was presenting. And that happens in your classes all the time, where we might be talking about a portrait, and then we end up leaving the class thinking about twice if we're sure to continue in this career. Why does this happen so often?
Well, it, you know, it's important to me that people who traditionally have been taken out of the field for financial reasons, for kind of subvocal bullying by professors, that they stay in the field. Because again, it's the urgency around the visual. And that's why the fight is so fierce. Because we're all protecting something.
Right.
And I think you guys are protecting the right things.
That's fair. I want to talk a little bit about one of the things that impacted me the most from your classes, that took me the longest to understand. And when I finally did, it has become the leading force on pretty much everything that I do, which is the idea of empathy as a social emotion. Mm-hmm. You talked about the perils and the dangers of empathy in class, and I thought, this old woman is crazy. I don't understand what she's doing. This is opposite of everything I learned. And you taught about it, and you always mention it. And every time you did, I will get more lost. I don't know how or when it hit. And it's a drive force on everything that I do, and from writing to reading to what I watch, everything. What do you mean by that? Social empathy is a social emotion. Mm-hmm. What are the dangers behind that? Because I talked about it in the podcast, and it also gets confusing because we're guided to empathize on everything that we do, especially from what we see in television to everything, from our families.
Well, part of the project in building a context for Edmonia Lewis was to study the abolitionist movement and to study first wave feminism in detail. And I think in part, well, let me back up and say that one of the tools or the weapons of first wave feminism and abolitionism was empathy. That you imagine yourself as the poor slave, right? They didn't use the terminology, the enslaved. But imagine yourself as the slave, and imagine the whip marks on your back. Imagine you experiencing their pain. And so it's an appropriation of embodied experiences that you don't have and that you can't have, but that you access through this fantasy of substitution. And so what it allows for is this fantasy of appropriated embodiment. And it makes you feel like you've done the work because you felt the right feeling.
So you're like, I'm done. I'm going to go buy myself a Starbucks.
And then I read Linda Bolton's book, Facing the Other, Ethical Disruption in the American Mind. And that book is a really great introduction to the philosophy of Emmanuel Levinas. And she's going through the kind of the founding documents of the United States, from the Declaration of Independence to de Tocqueville's book on democracy in America to Frederick Douglass's slave narrative. And she notes by way of Levinas that empathy is a pre-ethical emotion. Mm-hmm. It is not an action. It is an emotion. It is an imagined substitution of that person for the self. And it says that the only way that I can act on your behalf is to reduce you to me. Mm. So the terms of my reaction are based on my ability to appropriate your experiences.
And that's to a certain degree the Medusa behind a lot of the art, or most art created, I will say, mm-hmm. that you're supposed to have this. There's like a pre-established experience before you even look at the mm-hmm. image, mm-hmm. that you're supposed to feel a certain way. Yep. Or as Shirley Samuel says, feeling right. Mm-hmm. So with its applications in art history mm-hmm. are important to try to allow for a different context of the object outside of emotion. Mm-hmm. How do you then apply some of these ideas to your artists? Because I know, and especially looking around your mm-hmm. house is full of art from your students. Mm-hmm. How do you apply some of these ideas to the act of creating as opposed to the act of writing, of making? That I guess both are similar, but what about artists? How do you approach some of these ideas that we're talking about in art history, but to the actual making of objects?
Mm-hmm. My students' art is a different experience for mm-hmm. me, because this work was made when they were graduate students mm-hmm. and I served on their committee, and I know what they went through. I know the conversations we had. Mm-hmm. I know what comes out of those conversations. Mm-hmm. And so the work is personal in a way that a poster isn't, in a right. way that a work made by someone whom I don't know isn't. And, you know, it's not just student art. It's my plants. It's my family photographs. You know, it's all of that. But in terms of empathy, it is, I think it's the cause of so many failed civil rights movements mm. that it allows mm. people to pretend to feel the same way right. about an experience. Whether it's a lynching photograph or a sculpture, the pretense or empathy as a social emotion mm-hmm. says that no, there aren't people who actually become titillated or sexually excited by mm-hmm. the sight of a Black man hanging from a tree.
Right,
and we see empathy as a social emotion. When we're forced to see George Floyd being murdered.
Right.
When we are forced to watch the video of 12-year-old Tamir Rice being shot. Mm-hmm. The only way that we can empathize with the death of Black children and Black people is to witness their lynching.
Right.
And so there's something wrong with empathy.
Yes.
If, you know, if the conditions aren't met, we can't feel for you. So we can't act on your behalf.
So with that in mind, are there any artists practicing today that you say are thinking about these ideas in, I guess I don't have the right, in a good way, a different way, maybe like trying... almost like a, not a distraction, but like a space around all this noise, because empathy is everywhere. Mm-hmm. The encouragement of empathy is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Are there any spaces where you can breathe in the art of somebody that you can think of?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are lots of artists. I mean, Renee Stout, Howard Dina Pindell, Mark Bradford. There are lots of artists whom I admire and whose work I enjoy. The curators who, you know, are aware of these issues, like Andrea Barnwell Brownlee, mm-hmm. Jeffrine Hayes, Naomi Beckwith, Valerie Cassell Oliver. Yeah, I mean, I have, yeah.
So there's plenty.
Yeah, there's plenty.
Okay,
there's
good.
Plenty. Yeah.
So... Then how do you push your students to decenter themselves in these narratives? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about artists. Mm-hmm.
It's a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
You know, I try and meet them where they're at. Mm-hmm. That's a fact, something a student wrote to me once.
What?
That she was thanking me for always meeting her where she was at. Mm. And I was like, yeah, that's what I try and do.
You're like, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
That's me.
That's me.
You're welcome. That's so you've been in the University of New Mexico for how long?
20 years.
20 years. Mm-hmm. And you work on this book. There's a second printing of the Edmona Lewis book.
Yes.
Tell us the title, the full title.
It's Child of the Fire, which is taken from Emerson. Mm-hmm. And it's Child of the Fire, Mary Edmona Lewis, and the Problem of Art History's Black and Indian Subject.
What's next?
Well, let me say this. Uh-huh. I think of that book as my hate letter to art history.
Uh-huh. Woo-hoo. That's why we read the introduction in a lot of my classes.
Yes, it's my hate letter to art history. What's next? I am working on a book on Kara Walker.
Kara Walker.
Yes.
Why Kara Walker?
Because she's been doing the same thing for about 30 years and has amassed a fortune because of it. Mm-hmm. But what interests me is not so much her mm-hmm. as the institutions that work to make her relevant and to make her important. She won the MacArthur Genius Award at age 24.
Wow.
And you know, one of the major texts through which I see everything is Michael Baxendall's Patterns of Intention.
Brilliant art historian.
Brilliant art historian mm-hmm. who talks about the function of description as the mediating element of explanation, mm-hmm. right? How we describe is how we create meaning. So he's made me very aware of description. He's made me very aware of what he calls intention or patterns of intention.
Patterns of intention.
That the artwork is a solution to a problem in a situation, and that by reconstructing solution, problem, situation, you create this thing that's outside of the object,
right.
but that can speak to the object or speak around the object. And so one of the things that interests me about Kara Walker's work is how description fails. Mm. A lot of her silhouettes deal with horrific imagery that if her subjects had faces, they could never be on museum walls.
Right.
Because it's, you know, children performing fellatio on adults or sucking dick, you mm-hmm. know. and art historians can't describe that, so they describe all around it. Mm-hmm. And I'm always interested in liberation narratives. And so how emancipation rhetoric flows around her work that's centered on the plantation is of interest to me. Mm. Here it is a misuse and a misfiring of a liberation narrative mm-hmm. when it comes to her work. And so, yeah. I mean, the connection I make between Lewis and Walker is on a YouTube video, if you're interested. It's a two-part video called Slavery Makes the Woman.
Okay. We'll put a link of that to that in our webpage. Before we end, mm-hmm. I know that a constant in your life and a supporter has been your sister.
Yes.
I want to give her a shout out.
Okay.
Because every time I think of you, I think of your sister, mm-hmm. even though I've only met your sister once.
It's only been once?
It's only been once. That was in Toronto.
Oh, okay.
That was in Canada. And every time I think of you, I'm always wondering how your sister is doing. Mm-hmm. And I see her as an extension of you. And I know she, when you tell me that she's there sharing you in all of your panels, even when you don't even want to be there, I think of my parents because mm-hmm. that's how my parents are. Mm-hmm. My parents will go see me perform art history, even though I don't want to be there, but they're like in the first row. So like, I don't know. I don't know if you want to say anything about your relationship with your sister.
She is ride or die.
Okay.
Always has been. She's about 2 years younger than I am. And the day she was born, she became the boss of me. I was always a little bit slow, and she learned to tie her shoes first. So I remember her. I remember her on her knees tying my shoes, and you know, just bossing me around, and it's never stopped. In the 55 years since she's been around, everyone's afraid of her.
I love your sister.
She's very short. I think she overcompensates.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I just love her. Yeah.
Shout out to your sister and your family.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So, is there anything you want to add? Is there any besides your book? Everybody should buy your. It's on my top books on the website, and I talked about this book a lot. Even though it sounds like I don't read it, because I will ask you for advice, and you're like, read my fucking book.
It's on page 10. Not even that deep into the book.
When I ask you that question and you're like, read my book, I feel so guilty that I bought a second copy.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so I'm driving.
But do you have the Kindle version?
Yes.
Okay.
I actually downloaded Kindle against my will because I hate Amazon just so I can read your fucking book. So I have it on digital media, and I have it signed in my house.
Very good.
In Chicago, yes. Yes. So besides your book, is there anything you're reading right now? Is there anything you're listening to right now? Is there anything you're doing right now that you're like, this is what I'm doing right now, I want to recommend it? Or
let's see. I just read a book by Wendy Belyon. I think that's how you pronounce her name. But it's Iconoclasm in New York. And it's about a statue of King George III that was taken down in 1776, about Liberty Poles in Massachusetts. And it really helped me to think through iconoclasm and monuments and taking down monuments.
Oh, before I forget, tell the name of that article. I had signed it in my 100 classes, but I forget the name of the article. With the woman doing the performance outside of Wall Street.
Oh,
it's that, online, and that everybody can
the
read
the name
that
of the
good.
Article is untitled.
Oh, there you go. That's why I cannot remember it. What webpage?
For Panorama, which is a journal on American art, and I wrote about Nona Faustine, and she is a performance artist. She's a photographer. I'm sorry I'm not on social media anymore because I miss her reading her posts. But she did a white shoe series where she walked the sites of old slave markets and plantations in nothing but a pair of white shoes. And she stood there on a little crate that she brought with her and photographed herself. And Wall Street was one of the earliest slave markets. And it's ironic that it's now the financial center of the universe.
Right, right. So that's in Panorama. I'll put the link to that article. I'll put the link to your book, and they can buy it through Duke, not through Amazon. And again, this is just like the book is your hate letter to art history. This is my love letter to you and your family and your sister and your mother. I am so thankful for you every single day. There's not a single day, even when I'm in New Mexico, that I'm not thinking about you and the lessons you've given me. And every time I talk to a student, it's through your voice. And for that, I thank you. And this is not empathy. This is just the lessons that I've learned from you. And from that, my family, my husband, and everybody that knows me, it's thankful for that. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And thank you for being in the podcast.
Well, it's been the podcast. This was boring because I was only talking about myself.
That's what we want to hear.
But it's been a joy having you in my life. Like I said, I respect your mother too much. But if I'd had a child, I would have wanted that child to be you.
Well, there you have it. Thank you so much. I love you, Kristen.
Love you too. Let's have Kentucky butter cake.
Okay, let's do it. So now we're going to eat cake. That's it. And you know, everything is going to be on the website. And hasta la próxima. Ciao. Pues ahí lo tienen. A conversation with my mentor, part of the voice of this podcast, like an almost like an extension of the voice of this podcast, as I mentioned already in the introduction and also in the interview. Kristen, I love you so much. I'm very fortunate to have you in my life, and I'm excited to see your knowledge. I'm excited to see your words, and I'm excited to see your teachings being reflected not only in the work that I do, but in the work that now my students are doing. For that, there's no way I can ever repay you. I think you heard some of the recommendations. We talked about her book, Child of the Fire. We talked about Linda Bolton's Facing the Other. And we also talked about Michael Baxendall's Patterns of Intention. So those are three important books that I think, if you're interested in thinking about art in different ways, in analysis of art, or just if you're an art enthusiast, these are books that are not coffee table books, but are probably one of the most important, seminal books in thinking about not only art, because Facing the Other is not necessarily an art history book, but really makes you think about those encounters with objects. So that's important to keep in mind. In terms of music, I didn't want to give you anything of music. I really want this episode to be that space in between the rest of our episodes for us to think about some of the ideas that she brought, not only to this episode, but that she's bringing for a long, long time. So excited to continue the month of women art historians. Next is going to be Ananda Cohen. We're going to talk about Native resistance and in the Andes, and also talk about colonial art. But also, she's been doing some amazing things, highlighting BIPOC voices in academia, which is something that it's so necessary. So again, stay tuned for next week. And of course, we're going to come back and we'll have a conversation with Nandi, but we'll also have a conversation with Fabi, who also had the privilege to meet Kristen. And maybe he can tell us a little bit about what he thought about this interview. But as I mentioned before, I wanted to do this by myself, because this is besides my mother and my sisters, and I don't know, my husband and our families being in the podcast. This is one of the most personal, if not the most personal, interview that I've ever done. Thank you for indulging me. Thank you for indulging me not only with this interview, but indulging me for 5 years. It's meant a lot. This is not the end. We still have a couple of months, but I guess it's a good opportunity for everybody who listens to us. When I recommend a book, and when I was on Instagram, people just be taking pictures of Michael Trillo's Silence in the Past and posting them in my stories and things like that. Like, I never thought that would ever happen. So I could not end the podcast without talking to Kristen. Thank you, everyone. I love you. And well, you'll hear again from us next week. Ciao.